ESPN, in partnership with Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions, present Moxie Bets. Make bets with Moxie with betting expert Kate Mox and her merry band of gambling insiders as they preview lines, spreads, parlays, and props with personality and the kind of advice they would give themselves. That's Moxie Bets. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, a podcast about, well, whatever the hell I want. Actors and musicians, athletes, comedians, neuroscientists, wine experts. If I find somebody interesting, I'm bringing them to you. We'll talk about how they became who they are, how they found success, battled failures, and how they ended up here talking to me.
My name is Lucia Agnello, and my dilemma is I'm worried my son won't have clean water in 50 years.
So I don't know a ton about drinking water issues in America, but I do know that the clean water crisis goes well beyond Flint, Michigan. A recent report has 2.2 million Americans living without clean drinking water, and I just saw a pretty compelling and smart look at it. Just one aspect of it, really, in the American West from last week tonight. It was the episode from June 26, John Oliver, looking at water issues in the West. I have no solutions. I find myself once again hoping that some of our best minds are on this problem, along with many other problems, and that they're listened to. Because I think one of the great plagues of our country right now is a turn towards anti-intellectualism, a distrust of or rejection of experts, and valuing the opinions of the everyman as the same, or more accurately, the loudest platformed everyman over those that are doing the work and using science and research and facts to back up their policy suggestions or their advocacy. So yeah, I fear for your son and for everyone else's kids, my nieces and nephew, for reasons beyond water. That is one of them. But for instance, another mass shooting. This time it was in Highland Park, Illinois, which is the town right next to my hometown where I grew up. It's a place where my friends live now, where my friends had to grab their kids in the middle of a 4th of July parade and run home. A place where my friend's friend was shot in the chest. He's hopefully going to make it through. A place where parades and fireworks and all the celebrations of our alleged freedoms were canceled for thousands of people near Highland Park because of the freedom that we elected to afford one very sick 22-year-old man to buy a high-powered rifle and to be able to tear apart the bodies of his victims with a gun that nobody needs or should have. And his right to that deadly weapon was protected and has been fought for, while women's rights to their own bodies have been stripped, while Black people see another one of their own in Jalen Walker shot dozens of times by police after a traffic stop. And as we know, and as we could say over and over and over again, justice and liberty for all, not the way of this country, never has been. So I didn't really celebrate the 4th of July yesterday with any real patriotism. Instead, I sort of mourned our country's deeply fragmented nature. This terrifying push of fascism, our backsliding rights, our movement towards a Christian theocracy. And I was thinking about it and was reminded of the famous Langston Hughes poem, Let America Be America Again, and this super powerful line. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be, the land where every man is free. Now, I'd amend that to every person is free, because we've seen what happens when man appears in historical writings instead of person or human being. Women end up not being considered one. So yeah, I didn't really celebrate the 4th, but not because I don't love America, or at least the idea of America, the land that never has been yet, but that was dreamed up and promised and celebrated despite never living up to that promise. I love that idea. I wish we were closer to it. There's this poet and cultural critic, Hanif Abdurraqib, and I've quoted this line a number of times. He wrote about how a true love of place is fighting for its betterment. And the quote is, it's an active love. I'm not watching with my face against the glass adoringly. I'm in a cage with it, fighting with it. It doesn't live up to its potential to serve everyone who lives here equitably. For me to want to transform that, you need love. So for your son, Lucia, for all of our children and their children and their children, let's hope we get our shit together and fast.
That's What She Said.
Welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. one of the top 14 sports podcasts around, according to Esquire magazine. Forgot to mention that before, but a belated thanks to Esquire and to writer Brady Langman for the honor. If you agree with it, you can feel free to head over to iTunes or Apple Pods. You could subscribe and follow. That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. You could leave a review, a nice one, hopefully. 5 stars, please, hopefully. That'll help others find and enjoy the pod. But thanks to Esquire for that. After a month of really what I thought was fantastic Title IX related content, very sportsy content, we're going outside the sports world a bunch this month, and we're starting with today's incredible guest, Lucia Aniello. She's director, writer, and producer. She's best known for co-creating, writing, producing, directing, all the things for Hacks, for which she won multiple Emmy Awards. Also her work on Broad City. Other work includes the 2017 film Rough Night, Babysitter's Club, and Awkwafina is Nora from Queens. We talk about her life as a young tennis star going off to Columbia, meeting and making a life with her creative partner and husband, Paul W. Downs, a pivotal arrest, how she cut her teeth on Broad City, the thrilling success of Hacks and how it's changed her life, getting to work with Jean Smart, upcoming projects, also how she's managed to squeeze in a wedding, an Emmys win, and a new baby while making season 2 of Hacks, which is out now on HBO Max. I think you're going to love this one. Here's Lucia Aniello.
That's what she said.
So a big thank you goes out to Honest Games' Joyce Anderson, who you all heard on this podcast a few weeks ago talking Title IX and compliance for sports. But she made the introduction to this week's guest after, I believe we started talking about Cornell versus Columbia. And so our guest is here. Maybe we'll talk a little Columbia tennis, but more importantly for her creative endeavors. Let's go back to growing up. Were you more of a jock or a creative or both?
I think kind of both. I played tennis with Joyce at Columbia, and I was a pretty serious junior tennis player. But I also, whenever I was home, would be taking drum lessons and be going to concerts and, trying to get my friends to write plays with me, and nobody wanted to. So, I think I was kind of always a little bit of both, to be honest.
What did you like in terms of content? Were you watching old Saturday Night Live or sitcoms on TGIF, or what were you watching?
Yeah, I actually was watching SNL a lot because my mom really liked it. And this was the Molly Shannon, Sherry O'Terry era, the sweaty balls era. And my mom really liked it. And she would come, my parents owned a restaurant, restaurants in Amherst, Massachusetts. And my mom would work on the weekends, but she would come home around 11 or 11:30. And so I would still be up because I was, probably with my babysitting my younger siblings. And so we would watch it. And so and she would laugh so hard. And so I don't know, there was something about that time where I was like this, I think it was kind of formative, but I was watching a lot of MTV. I was watching a lot of Real World Road Rules was my jam. Mm-hmm. I was watching a lot of VH1 Behind the Music. I was really into honestly just the idea of what is kind of youth culture in a time where I was even younger, but I was really hungry for it. And I was excited to just be I used to watch a lot of music videos and record them on VHSs. So I was really into that kind of stuff too. But I was really just into what is the cool stuff. And I grew up in Western Mass, right in between Amherst and Northampton in a town called Hadley. So I had access to kind of cool stores and venues and things that were nearby, but it really was the kind of thing where you had to still kind of seek it out, even though it was nearby.
Right.
Because even you're, in eighth grade, you're not necessarily it was nearby. So yeah, I found myself wanting to go to Northampton and walk around and go to, CD shops and go to Newbury Comics in Amherst and just try to soak it all in, because I was just it was just all really exciting, interesting to me.
It's funny when you get older and you think kids are quote unquote too young for stuff. And then you remember that you were reading, 17 magazine or whatever, when you were actually 11 and you were going to college towns and wanting to be cool and understand. Even didn't mean you were doing illegal things or being led down a bad path. There's just an aspiration to be older at that age. There's a curiosity that I think leads you to a lot of that stuff. You mentioned that your parents had a restaurant. I believe were you born in Italy but grew up is it safe to say it was Italian?
Yes, I was born in Anzio, which is outside of Rome. And my mom is like Italian American first generation. My dad came to America when he was 17. They met and married in Boston and then kind of went back to Italy to kind of honeymoon slash maybe live there. And then I was born then. And then my mom was kind of like, this isn't it for me. I'm coming back. And my dad kind of was like, yeah, let's bring her back. So I ended up growing up in Western Mass, because my parents kind of felt like there's a lot of college kids there. There was like a need for, you know, some more Italian food and pizza and restaurants and stuff. So they felt that that was a great place to raise us. And actually it was a really amazing spot. And I got into tennis there because my parents love tennis, but this really awesome guy, Art Carrington, who's a tennis coach out in Western Mass, who's had a club there for that worked out of Hampshire College for decades. He was my coach, and he was, you know, really kind of a magnet for so many kids in the Western Mass area, who would play tennis. And, you know, there's so many kids who've come through that pipeline, that Art Carrington and his son, Lex Carrington, that, you know, it's a thing. And, you know, being a part of that community, you know, like brought me out of my shell in terms of like, it wasn't just the same kids that I grew up with my whole life. Cause the town of Hadley is actually quite small.
Right.
And you grew up with the same 50 kids your whole life, but this was an opportunity for me to meet kids of different backgrounds. And even Art would like bring me to, you know, the Y in Springfield and have me take boxing classes with, you know, girls that, you know, are very different than me. And so, you know, being a part of that really, it changed my life in a lot of ways, not just the tennis, but also the community that it brought me.
Yeah, that's really cool. Actually, my sister was a big tennis player growing up, and she did, you know, tennis Europe and stuff. She ended up playing at Lehigh, but she got to travel a lot. And same thing, sort of, I think we often maybe don't recognize as much, because we're so used to being athletes, how much it teaches us about adversity and leadership and teamwork and working with people we don't like and everything else. So lots of lessons to be gained there. You go on to play at Columbia, and you were a film and media studies major. Was that an instant thing? You got there and you were like, this is why I'm going here and this is what I want to do? Or did you gradually happen upon the focus?
No, I very much knew that I wanted to be in really, actually, I thought TV more than film, to be honest, when I first, you know, started out. And so when I was visiting colleges and deciding where I was going, I was definitely like looking specifically at those programs. The major at Columbia Film Studies is really more of like a classical film history program, and, you know, criticism as well is a big part of it, at least for me. They have a grad program, which I didn't do, but, you know, it wasn't exactly, I think, perfect for, or at least at the time, I didn't think it was ideal, the most ideal program for me. But in retrospect, it was an amazing thing because I got to watch so many different films and just be exposed to so many things that I otherwise wouldn't have been if I was just kind of more of a like media studies major. And so, yeah, it was a great program for me. But when I came out, I didn't think that I was going to be a director, even when I was done with the program. It was really only, you know, when I started going to UCB, because I literally just Googled Amy Poehler, because I was just like, I want to be Amy Poehler. And so
all?
I was like, literally just, yeah, exactly. Still do. You know, once I found the UCB Theater, which was still, you know, it had been going on for a couple of years, and I had been like vaguely familiar with their Comedy Central show. But I literally just took a class. I had been exposed to improv at Columbia, because actually, you know, like Jenny Slade and Mac and Gabe Liebman and all these really great people were doing improv and were like, you know, part of this like thing that was a thing. And even Kate McKinnon was a part of it. But I still didn't like see it and think, I'm going to do that. I don't know why it didn't really like strike me until kind of after college that I wanted to do it. But I also had dropped out of high school after my sophomore year and got my GED. And so
let's go back to that. What was going on then?
I was basically kind of like plateauing in my tennis, where I was just like, I'm not getting to train enough. All these like girls who are playing at these like, you know, academies in Florida are beating my ass. Like, I need more time to train. And also I was not really like loving my high school. No offense, Hopkins Academy, Hadley, Mass. It was just not really like my thing. It was, I don't know. There was like a guidance counselor there at the time who I was like talking to him about like this kind of schools I would want to go to. And he was just like, you have no chance. Don't even bother applying. you should be going to these schools instead. Like just take yourself down a peg. And I was just kind of like, no, I don't want to. And I was just like, this isn't like, it wasn't at the time. I don't really know what the school's like now. The teachers were great, but I just, or some of them, but I just wasn't finding myself being like inspired to be what I felt like I could be. And so I was kind of just like, all right, I'm out of here. My parents were super supportive. They were like, cause in my dad, you know, they're like very like entrepreneurial. You got to do it yourself. Like, yeah. So because of that, and they were like, we know you work hard. We know that you're dedicated. We know no one can tell you no. So go and do it. And so I dropped out, got my GED, and I enrolled in Holyoke Community College, which is the area community college. Went there for 2 years. And then I transferred at 16. Yeah.
Wow.
And then I transferred to Columbia. So I came into Columbia with a bunch of credits already. And so I was actually only there for 3 years.
And were you, 18 or 19 when you got to Columbia? So starting around the same age as the rest of your peers?
Exactly. Starting at the same age, but being done a year early.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That year early was a kind of a really big deal for me because I'm somebody who very much was like, I got to get it together. What am I doing? What is happening? But I was like, listen, this is a year of my life that ordinarily I would be in college. And I'm also, you know, saving a bunch of money by not going, being in college right now. So I was like, I'm going to give myself like a year to just kind of figure it out. And that's when I took a UCB class. And it's also where I met my now husband and collaborator, Paul. We met at level one. And yeah, it was like, it was a time where I didn't put a lot of pressure onto myself. And of course, that's exactly when things started to come together for me.
Right. So tell me about work. So you, I mean, being at UCB, if you have to pay for the class. And also, I presume you were living in New York City?
Yes. Yes.
So how do you pay for that?
I waited tables.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always fascinated by people's, early jobs. Yeah, usually that's it.
Yeah, I waitressed. I waitressed at a couple different restaurants, but the one that was like my main there for a bunch of years was Koi in the Bryant Park Hotel, which was, a Japanese restaurant that, it was fancy. And I had, because my parents had restaurants, I was able to kind of like be like, I know what I'm doing enough to get this job. And I wasn't the best waiter, but I also was kind of good.
Pretty
because
good.
I was I wasn't necessarily somebody who could like talk to you endlessly about the sake. I just like know what they would tell me. But, and I say this a lot, but like waiting tables is to me the best education you can have actually for directing or show running or something, because, you know, you get really used to dealing with front of house, back of house, talking to all different kinds of people. You kind of have to adapt your personality and the way you communicate based on the people, and you have to do it immediately. And you also get so like overwhelmed in the weeds. We're running behind. This table needs that. You're an hour behind on the day, like all the same things. And you just have to learn how to like block out the anxiety and just figure out what's the next thing I have to do and just work through it efficiently and pragmatically. And yeah, I think there's like so many lessons in waitressing and in directing, to be honest, or waitering. I guess men might learn lessons too.
Right. Sometimes we wish more often. My first job when I moved to LA to try to do comedy was in a restaurant, and it remains the most stressful job I've ever had, despite being on television. And I just did an event with the First Lady and interviewing, you know, Michael Jordan. Like it doesn't matter. Yeah. The most stressful job I ever had was working in a restaurant in Century City. Okay, so let's talk about Gulfstream in the Century City Mall. Gulfstream.
Wow.
Yeah. I helped open that joint, which is a Houston corporation, those restaurants are very corporate. So, you know, you
sounds
can get written
like it,
up for smiling
in the name,
without
honey?
Your mouth open. Good times. Okay, let's get back to Upright Citizens Brigade, because I love this meet cute. It's very good. You and Paul, who plays the agent for Jean Smart and Ava in Hacks, your superstar comedy. You guys meet there, and I want to know when you recognize that it wasn't an admiration of talent so much as like, oh, this feeling is different and I want to work together and more.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if there was like a single moment really. Like when we first met, day one, I was like, this kid is hilarious. I was like, I've never experienced thinking somebody's this funny in person before. Of all the stand-up shows or whatever shows I've ever seen, I was like, this guy is so funny and magnetic. And I did think he was cute, but he had really, really long hair and like boot cut jeans and like cowboy boots. Like,
oh boy.
The look was, we were not exactly sure what was going on here. We were like, what's this guy
and
about?
This was, let's see, 2007-ish, 2005. Oh yeah, very awkward time for us all.
Yeah, the Zathan's diesel jean trend was throwing everyone off. But we were friends for sure at first, and I definitely knew, the thing I knew for sure was that I just wanted to be like around him. I was like, I think he's so funny. I want to take the same classes he's taking. Let's go. Hey, let's meet up and go to dinner, you know, before class or whatever it was. Like, I was just like, this is a new friend of mine who I really like being around. And, you know, we started spending more and more time together. And, you know, it was like, then it like slowly kind of turned romantic in a way, but like not like straight up to like, oh yeah, this is like, I don't know how to describe it, but it was very, very slow evolution into a relationship. I wouldn't say that we were really into an actual relationship for about almost 2 years. And actually it was from the time that he got arrested. If you want to hear that story.
I was unaware of this. Yes. I would love to hear that story.
So he and I were leaving a party in Midtown. And at the time, for some reason, he like had his like car from college. He went to Duke. He had his car from college, like in Brooklyn or in New York at the time. And I don't know why, but he's like, all right, I'm going to drive us back to Williamsburg, where we both lived at the time. And like within a block, he got pulled over. And I had had I was super high, but I think he had just eaten a pot cookie, but was not high yet. He was like sober. So he's like, let me drive us before anything happens. So he gets pulled over. Turns out from like years prior, he had gotten a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt in New York or something, and didn't know that he hadn't paid the ticket because it got sent to North Carolina.
Oh no.
And he like didn't live there anymore. And so in any case, there's something called or was called Scott's Law, where if you owe the city or state money, you can be arrested, essentially. So they arrested him. Mm-hmm. And So
you're extremely
basically
high,
so that night,
all
I'm like
going over really well for you.
I'm extremely high. I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh my God. They're like, can you drive this car? I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely not. I'd drive it like one block and like just pull over. But eventually I like go to the police station and I'm like, hello, sirs. May I get out my friend? And they're like, no. And I was like, okay. Except for one guy was like, yeah, give me a ride back to, you know, Yonkers and I'll see what I can do. And I was like, oh God, this is bad.
God, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in any case, whenever he like calls, you know, cause he would get an opportunity to call every couple hours, you know, I was just like so worried about him, and it just like put everything into perspective for me and for him. So like after that, it was more like, this is my person. I really, really care about him. And
just like
that
the Bachelor
is what we consider our anniversary.
Trauma together.
That's
why they make them like skydive and shit. Because once they go through those traumatic experiences, they feel bonded. I believe this is the same thing that happened when my friend's older boyfriend at Cornell came back to visit right before the start of our senior year. We decided to streak the campus to welcome the freshmen to school. And so he drove us, like eight of us, in the back of an SUV. And before we could even get out to take off the limited towels and such that we'd worn in the car to get there, he got pulled over from previous on-campus tickets and arrested. And some of us who were high, not me, also were extremely paranoid and dove out the back of the SUV and just started running across campus in a towel trying to figure out where our next meetup would be. It was very well planned. And that is a good law for people to know about in New York, as it turns out.
Yes.
Okay. So now you're together and you're, it's very cool to like just start creating your own digital shorts and doing improv together, starting your own website, deciding that you want to have this creative life together. What was the first project you did where you were like, I think we're good at this. I think other people think we're good at this too.
Well, I guess we made this one short at Paul's parents' house also involves another getting pulled over story, but we'll see if I get to that. But it was maybe like fourth or fifth video we made, because at this is like, now is when I start being like, I guess I should be directing, is because, you know, I was having trouble getting stage time at UCB. I was putting up shows that weren't getting runs. Justice for my sketch shows that never got a run. But, you know, Paul was having more success, but I was just kind of like, I want to be doing more. I want to be making things. And so because I had taken like literally one production class, or I made one short at Columbia, I was like, I can do it. I can figure it out. I like, you know, went on YouTube to learn how to edit on like Final Cut. And I just literally taught myself how to do coverage and figure out what all these things mean, just truly by Googling. And so I started making some shorts. And the first one that we made that I think was like something was, I don't even know what it's called, Thanksgiving dinner, or the last Thanksgiving, I think is what it was called, last Thanksgiving, where basically Paul played every family member at a Thanksgiving dinner table. So we basically just like locked off the camera once we [S2] Nice. [S1] Were on one side, and he would go to the other side and go and like try to, you know, do all the lines. But it was scripted, but it was also kind of improvised, which makes no sense if you're trying to be everybody at the table. It feels like it would need to be heavily scripted. But
right.
That one took a long time to shoot. It took a long time to edit. And if you go back, I don't know, it's probably online somewhere. I haven't seen it in at least a decade. But it's like, you know, really messy in so many ways. But it did get Paul, immediately got him like meetings with managers. Oh, I think he may have gotten he did screen test for SNL, and I think it was based on that short, maybe, probably. And so when he got called out to LA, it was like meet with a bunch of managers, and you know, he said to all of them, like, I would love to, you know, sign with you, but you have to sign my partner too. Wow. Because this is like, yeah, because it this is who I'm making stuff with, and you know, she's not in front of the camera, but we come as a team. And so that's how I got representation, was from Paul kind of forcing people to sign me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It seems to have worked out. We'll get right back to the interview. But first, what's your favorite word?
Juxtapose.
Juxtapose. To place two or more objects side by side or close together. Etymologists think that juxtapose is a back formation. So that's a word that comes about through removing the prefix or suffix of a longer word. They think it was created when people trimmed down the noun juxtaposition. And historical evidence supports that juxtaposition shows up in the 17th century and the verb juxtapose in the 19th. Juxtaposition is a combination of Latin juxta, meaning near, and French position. So learned about that too, back formation. Juxtapose. Good word. Speaking of great words,
you're going to learn today.
The word of the week is herkel-derkeling, staying in bed long after you should have got up. It's from 18th century southern Scotland, and we've talked about reduplicative words before, hoity-toity, okie-dokie, etc. Most of the time, the first word holds the meaning, and the second is likely sort of a made-up term to rhyme with it. So herkel means to draw up the limbs and crouch or squat. To draw the limbs together close to the body. So you could sort of imagine someone languishing in bed, sort of in the fetal position, putting off work or productivity. One of the earliest examples is for Dr. Jameson's Scottish Dictionary and Supplement, Volume 3 of 1841. And here comes my terrible Scottish accent attempting to read this. Lang after peeping Greek o' day, in herkel dirkel habile, gay te your work, your durnin' merkel, and lie nay there in herkel dirkel. Nailed it. All right, in a sentence. After a month of extensive travel and extra work in celebration of the 50th anniversary of Title IX, Sarah didn't blame herself for herkel dirkeling most mornings of the July 4th holiday weekend. Now let's get back to the interview. When you were at Upright Citizens Brigade, you met Alana Glazer, and Alana and Abby Jacobson started doing Broad City, and mm-hmm. Paul, your partner, was cast mm-hmm. as the boss of Abby's character on the show, the trainer at the gym, and the pilot gets picked up by Comedy mm-hmm. Central, and you guys both become writers for the show. That, I presume, was your first real, like, we're on a project that's funded and supported. What was that like for you?
Yeah, that was definitely our first TV job. I mean, it was incredibly stressful to direct the pilot of that because I had never directed for television at all. I'm being handed a pilot to direct of my good friends who I love and care about so much. And I know how much they have poured their heart and soul and every penny they've ever earned into this project. And so I know how much it means to them. And, I've never worked for Comedy Central. I don't know anything about anything really. And so I'm like stressed the hell out because it like means so much to them, even more though so than for myself. Obviously, like I want to do a good job to get my career going, but it was really because I was like, this means so much to them, it needs to be good. So we shot the pilot, and it did eventually get picked up, which is amazing. But we did some, there was some retooling of the pilot and some reshooting of stuff. So Paul actually wasn't in the original pilot. Originally, Abby was working at a coffee shop.
Okay.
And then for whatever reason, it got changed to being working at a gym. I think it just kind of felt like coffee shop workplace had been done before and people weren't really tapped into the like, the kind of like, Soul cycle-y,
Right.
equinoxy, new agey New York
Yeah.
gym culture. So yeah, so that got, so actually Paul was cast once the season got picked up. And then they did ask us both to join as writers.
That's
So
so cool.
it was
That's an
amazing.
incredible show.
Yeah.
It's an incredible
Thank you.
show. It was so visionary. It was so different. Some of the like musical sequences and the creativity. I literally to this day will often, in part because of my sports background, whenever Blake Griffin comes up, I'll be like, "Have you guys seen the Blake Griffin
Oh
sex episode of
my
Broad City?" And I'll be like, "All right, we're
God.
watching it right now. It's so good." What was your biggest takeaway as far as, being a professional and moving forward from working on that show?
I would say that, like making things with your friends is so incredible. It's like I get to wake up and make things with some of my favorite people on earth and get to hang out with them for work. Like that's crazy and it's so amazing. But the downside of it is like because there's so much like stress of like making a show and getting it done and making it the thing you want to be and everyone has an idea of what it wants to be and all these things, it can get really complicated. Like you have to make sure to keep your relationship as friends like the most important thing. You have to have like so much communication with like,
Yeah.
hey, this is bothering me. Hey, this is something that I felt bad about, or I'm sorry I did this, or whatever it is. Like if you're able to keep your friendship as like the thing you're protecting the most, then it actually makes a better project because you're not then dealing with hurt feelings or resentment or ego, which can happen with any creative collaboration, whether you're friends or not, of
Absolutely.
course.
Right.
But I think that that's the thing that like is really is the thing I came away with of just like it's really important to keep your personal relationships like solid and then it bleeds into the work because you're able to have more of a sense of play, more of a sense of happiness, and that is really what fuels comedy to me anyways, is being able to kind of feel free to joke around and do silly ideas and
Right.
pitches because then you actually strike something that you're like, oh, this is the thing we want to say or do, and I don't think you can get there if you're kind of sitting there upset about something else.
Agreed. I also think, and I don't, I, this is my limited experience, but in the spaces in which I work at ESPN that are predominantly women, I find we get to that best idea wins, no feelings are hurt faster than the spaces that are predominantly male. And I don't know if that was the case on that show at all, but there's a bit less of that like ego at play, I think, that lets you get past that initial, I'm hurt that you didn't like my idea or that this didn't work, and you just keep going until you get to the thing that does work. So you're working on that show and you start doing some other producing, including Time Traveling Bong, which I love that you had actually done academic work about time travel related content before, and that leads you to creating Time Traveling Bong. And then Rough Night, which the cast of this movie, and I have to admit, I have not seen this, and it's going to be a job of mine this weekend to watch. Based solely on the description, it sounds like something I should have seen already. Things go terribly wrong for a group of girlfriends who hire a male stripper for a bachelorette party in Miami. I'm in already. Mm-hmm. And then the cast is unbelievable. Scarlett Johansson, Kate McKinnon, Zoe Kravitz, Alana Glazer, Jillian Bell, who absolutely slays me in everything she does.
So good.
Ty Burrell, Demi Moore, Paul, your husband. So many good people. Eric Andre, Hasan Minhaj, like so many good people. Tell me about this movie. And tell me why you don't think it did as well as it could have or should have based on the cast and the ideas and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it was a spec script that Paul and I wrote while we were writing Broad City. I want to say maybe between seasons 2 and 3 we wrote it or something like that. And then we ended up writing it, I think, after season 4 of Broad City or something like that. But yeah, I mean, we wrote it on spec, which means that we wrote it without anybody asking us to. and then went out and sold it and got to make it, which was so exciting. I love the movie. I'm really, really, really proud of it. Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of like the financial box office or whatever, it's a weird, you know, it definitely like made them money. It's not like it, you know, bombed in a way that like really I don't think affected my career or anything there. I don't feel like I'm in movie jail, but you know, I don't know. I think that there was like a moment, you know, it came out in spring of 2017, you know, very, very early in the Trump administration. And I think that, I mean, I'm not blaming it on this in any case. I'm just trying to give it context.
We can blame whatever we want on things that we decide are to blame for many things.
So. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it was just, we were living in a moment where things were really like, I was really like bummed and stressed. And I think that the movie, it is a dark movie. You know, there is like death in it and blood and a lot of, you know, it talks about police brutality. Right. It's like, you know, it's not necessarily something you would put on to be like, I want to feel happy today. You know,
right.
It's not a joyous.
So it's really dark.
Yeah, it is. And I think especially by saying like, okay, we're going to do a summer comedy with all these really funny people, but it's pretty dark and stressful. I think there was something there that was like a little bit like, well, what is it? Is it fun? It's like, well, it's funny in a way. It's dark funny. And it's like, I don't know. I think that there was something a little bit like hard for people to want to necessarily sign up for something like that was a little bit, yeah, dark at the time. And maybe I'm wrong. And maybe, and there's been, trust me, a lot of people who I've really connected with it. And I'm like, so happy about that too. And when people are like, oh, I loved it. Then I'm like, oh, these are my people. So, right.
Well, and it doesn't always mean something. It's not a referendum on how good something is, how it does. Some of my favorite things don't move past an original season or two. And then there's other shows that are on forever that I'm like, who is watching this? This is terrible. How is this so popular? And actually that brings me to something else you worked on, the other two. You're a consulting producer on that show, which was freaking hilarious. So funny. And actually, if I remember correctly, was super highly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and everywhere else. It was from a couple Saturday Night Live head writers. Yes. So funny.
Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider created it.
Yeah. And basically, it's about a pair of siblings whose younger brother becomes like Bieber-esque and becomes famous and how they deal with who they are and who are we compared to our brother and all the weird, crazy things that happen. But tell me about working on that. And it feels like it got renewed for a second season for 2021, but maybe is not moving forward.
I think it is.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So the maybe second... just COVID slowed things down.
Yeah. So season 2 came out this past fall. And I think that's correct. And or late summer into fall. And they are, I believe, making season 3 right now for HBO Max. Awesome. That's the other thing. It was on Comedy Central and it's now moved over to HBO Max. Okay. But yeah, I mean, like Chris, like you said, Chris and Sarah, who created the show, are super, super funny. They were former head writers of SNL, and it has a fantastic cast. And yeah, it's like, you know, I think it's a show that, like, if you're looking to get some like serious, serious laughs, or like some of the funniest one-liners ever, and a really, really accurate, searing portray, you know, satire of what is going on in like kind of the pop culture industry. I mean, it's the show for you. It's definitely one that like, I think you can tune into any episode and just like laugh your ass off. And it also has a lot of heart as well. But yeah, Paul and I, we actually only worked on it for about 6 weeks, very early in season 1. and then wrote an episode and haven't really been super involved in it beyond that. But it was just, again, a case of just like, you know, our friends were like, let's talk and talk about the show and like figure it out. And I mean, they obviously, it was their show and they had it very much figured out, but they're really the driving force of that. We were just kind of there to be like, hey, what you're thinking is really good, you know?
Yeah. So how do you, when you're brought in for something like that, if you have very mm-hmm. strong opinions and you have things, you know, that you believe, how do you know based, is it, does it feel like that's clear based on the role of either executive producer or head writer or consulting, how much you can actually really dive in and give thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's actually something that Paul and I are doing far more now, because we have a deal with Warner Media as producers. And so we're actually producing a bunch of stuff with that studio right now. And it's really interesting, like the idea of, you know, people come in with ideas and they're like, they'll pitch them to you and you kind of decide like, hey, does this kind of align with the kind of storytelling that we think is, you know, funny or important or whatever it is, for whatever reason makes it interesting to us. And then we decide, you know, whether or not we want to kind of come on board as producers, and then we will work with the creatives to kind of shape it in whatever way. But I think it depends. It really depends on the project. Like sometimes people come in with like, here's my scripts. Here's my idea. Here's my full scripts. Here's my deck. Here's everything. And it's like, great, this is good. We have some thoughts here or there, take them or leave them. But we try to be very take it or leave it in general. But also some people will come in with just like a small idea for something. Here's a little bit of the idea. Let's talk it out and craft it together. And that's also something that I think really enjoy doing, as people are also just like students of television, honestly, of just like, we watch a lot of stuff. We love talking about what makes things work and not work, and also the alchemy of it, and also how you have no idea if it's going to work or not work. And so much of it is luck. And you know, whether you can have a great script, but if the cast just doesn't work in the moment, it just doesn't work. And you know, a lot of it's, in any case, that's something that we're doing a lot of right now. That's and cool. It's a really exciting time and for us, actually, in terms of being able to hop on board with other people's projects and add what we can add and step away when they have it, you know.
And then, you know, after that is really when you start taking full ownership of the projects in the last couple of years as executive mm-hmm. producer and showrunner and everything else. Quickly, let's hit on, because I really want to get to Hacks, but Babysitter's Club, you're a year or two younger than me, but that is like my childhood. Read every single one, poured through all of them. And you actually had to go looking for the rights, and you made this thing happen from the start, yes?
Yeah, I was very much like, you know, my agent was like, do you want to do this reboot or that reboot? And I was like, and I don't have connections to any of these things. And she's like, well, what do you have a connection to? And I was like, honey, Babysitter's Club. She's like, okay. So she tracked down, you know, who had the rights to it. It was Walden Media and Mike DeLuca. And I kind of just went in there and like poured my guts out about the show and what I wanted it to be. And then they were like, great, let's find a showrunner. Cause I wasn't available to do that at the time. And this fantastic, awesome writer, Rachel Schuchert, who comes from Glow and Supergirl and a ton of a huge, huge list of credits. I was also a super fan and had also an amazing vision for it. And so she and I, you know, really got to go and make this version of the TV version of the Babysitter's Club for Netflix that I am so proud of. We got to make.
People loved it.
Yeah.
And with Netflix, you never really know if it's going to keep going, even if everybody loves it, because of the nature of that service
algorithm,
how they operate. Yeah.
And unfortunately we were canceled after two seasons, which is heartbreaking, because there are so many girls that are, honestly, boys too, like, you know, I think that we're used to seeing, especially girls in media, being like children, little kids, and then the next piece of media they have for them is like teenagers who are like dating and having sex or whatever. Like, I think that age is that, you know, between 10 and 16, it feels like there just isn't a ton out there really, you know, in a way that is about, the show's really about like community, and the show is about like taking care of your friends and your family. And, you know, like the fact that there isn't really great childcare in this country, which was written in the 80s and is still true today. And so we have to like pitch in, we have to have like children pitch in as childcare in this country.
Child labor. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is crazy. But you know, if I, in any case, I really think that it was a really special show, and I'm really, really proud of it. And I'm happy at least it's up on the service for for girls and boys to grow into watching.
Concurrently, you were sort of doing the Awkwafina is Nora from Queens series. Were you show running on that and that's why you weren't available, or were you producing only on that one?
Yeah, on that one, I mostly just came in as like a director producer. So I directed the pilot and the first couple episodes, or I did the first like kind of block of episodes. But yeah, that one was just like, I love Nora. She's super funny. That's Awkwafina's real name. Yeah. And she's, you know, and like, I actually kind of signed on to that like before she really, really blew up, because I knew that she was about to be in Crazy Rich Asians, and I had loved the series, and I knew that who she was playing in it. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to blow her up so huge, because she's so funny and it was perfect. Yeah. And so I was like, whatever that project is at Comedy Central, I want to be a part of it. So Carrie Dornetto was a showrunner based on a pilot written by Nora and Teresa Hsiao. And yeah, so I was really, really excited to be a part of that, but I wasn't showrunning on that, no.
So let's get to Hacks, because I just could have spent this whole episode on it, and here we are, and we only have a few minutes left. But you created this with Paul and Jen Statsky, and yeah. I listened in an interview, and Paul talked about how inexplicably sort of you were in an area that had a monster truck rally going on, and somehow that coincided with a conversation about female comedians from the past who didn't get their due the same way as their male counterparts, and that landed you on the character that is played so perfectly by Jean Smart. But how does the rest of that show sort of start to come together?
Yeah, I mean, then we kind of needed, I think we wanted like a proxy for almost our POV as like younger comedians who followed in the footsteps of these women. And so that was kind of how we came up with the idea of Ava, somebody younger than us, that was kind of like, oh, who is that old hack? Who's that that woman? Oh, yeah, she's QVC. She's whatever. She's not somebody I take seriously. I'm cool comedy. I know what's going on, you know, and the hubris that comes along with somebody who has done quite well at a very young age, but hasn't necessarily learned a lot of lessons she needs to learn. So then it kind of became this two-hander idea of this relationship. And then from there, you know, this was, I think it was almost 8 years ago now that we actually had that road trip and came up with this idea. And Jen was writing on Parks and Rec, and then later The Good Place. And Paul and I were busy with a bunch of other stuff. And so, you know, it was the kind of thing where we're talking about it all the time. We're adding ideas to it. We actually went off and wrote a feature film that has yet to be produced in the meantime, Jen and Paul and I. And that was really, you know, when we started working together very seriously. Before that, it was just, you know, a little bit in Broad City. But that's when we started being like, okay, we really, really like working together. We have this idea for this show. It's been percolating for years. Once we were all available, then we pitched it. And we're really, really lucky to have find a great home at HBO Max when we pitched it to Susanna Makos. So it was, and then from there, we got the green light to make the pilot. Then COVID happens. So we had attached Jean Smart, but that was it, and Paul as the manager. And so then HBO said, listen, we're going to be shutting down for a while. Why don't you go ahead and write season one? And then when we're allowed to start shooting, you can just go ahead and shoot it. So we got a little lucky in that way that we got to just go and write the season. But on the other hand, then we hadn't cast it. So then once we cast it, we did go back and tweak some of the characters a little bit to make sense for the actors.
That's what I was going to wonder. Did you have Jean Smart in mind from the beginning when you were writing this character? Or did you create it around her once you cast her and start to make some changes based on her?
You know, the truth is that's one character we actually didn't make a ton of changes for based on the casting. We didn't originally have her in mind because, as she likes to say, she would have been far too young for it when we first thought of the show. But no, she was one that, you know, we wrote that character to be all these things, big, brassy, sexy, funny, sarcastic, mean, all those things. And, you know, we were really swinging hard for that character. And I think in the hands of a lesser actor, we would have had to adapt it to say, oh, well, you know, she's really funny at this, but less good at this drama stuff, or she, you know, has some weaknesses. But with Jean, we didn't have to ever do that. We got to write the character as we wanted to write it, and she was able to do everything we needed. So we didn't actually have to adapt that character at all, which was amazing.
She's fantastic. I mean, I was watching her in Designing Women when I was little, and now obviously she's done so much stuff since then, some really incredible roles. But then she's at 70, sort of peaking again with Watchmen and Mare of Easttown and Hacks and all these Emmy Award nominations and wins. So it's such a cool thing that you are wanting to honor comedians and women who didn't get their due while simultaneously giving this incredible role to a woman later in her career. And it's so fun to watch. But I want to hear about Hannah Einbinder, because that's not someone that you had cast. And I wonder how much the role of Ava was formed around getting to know her.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. She's such a unique actor, and like her cadence, the way she talks is so specific and unique that like, even though we had made a couple changes based on her, but she makes it so her own just in the way that she's so naturally herself. So I think almost in some ways, the ways that she's adapted the character are a little bit like the nuance is just literally in the way that she breathes and talks and the way she says words. But she's somebody who actually fit the description of the character incredibly well. We wanted somebody like a bisexual woman who's performance of gender was a little bit, you know, like not especially feminine. We actually wrote a character, you know, we had this runner about somebody with big hands, mm-hmm. and then we cast her and she's like, oh, you know, I have big hands. And we were like, she's like, you must've written that in once, you know, you cast me. And we're like, no, that was already in. And in the finale of season one, there's a photograph of her hands on like this large blue, I don't know, sculpture from when she was a kid, when she was like 12, and her hands look enormous. And I think Deborah says positively extraterrestrial. And those are her actual hands. There was no Photoshop. That was actually her hands. So things like that just like happened to fall into place. Yeah. But like,
but
for example, Hannah added
role, right? This, I mean,
yeah, she's never acted
insane.
Before. Psycho.
And she just decided she wanted to act and this happened to be her first big get, or how did she end up coming in for the role?
Well, she's a stand-up, and she's like very much a stand-up. Like she works all kinds of different comedy rooms, alt rooms, more traditional rooms. Like she had done Colbert right before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right around when we were casting her. So that was basically her only credit. And the only way to see her, if you Googled her, was just this one set on Colbert. But she like, you know, her reps were like, hey, you want to audition for stuff? And she's like, they had signed her as a stand-up. And she's like, yeah, sure. I'll audition for things. But I think she said I don't know if she ever even got a single call back before the show.
Wow.
And, you know, the first time that we saw her was back when we were still making a pilot, which ended up not happening. But that was the first time we saw her. And I remember us saying like, now that's she's very interesting, because she matched the character so well. You believed her as a writer. I mean,
right.
God love them, but there's so many actresses that came in that were so beautiful that I'm like, I don't know if I can buy you a comedy writer. Not to say you can't have both.
Of course.
There's plenty of us who can. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, there's something about Hannah where you could believe, like, you know, she would be kind of one of these hot comedy writers in LA.
Absolutely.
And there's just something very believable about her. I think partly because she's
confidence plus deeply seated insecurity to perfectly fit mm-hmm. that kind of ingenue who's, you know, figuring it out. It's so good. I wonder how different it feels that this show takes off. All of these awards, acclaim, people love it. How different that feels, how magical this run has felt. I mean, you squeezed a wedding to Paul in, mm-hmm. it was delayed over a year, and then you end up mm-hmm. having it in Italy just a couple days before the Emmys, and then you win a bunch of Emmys. And I mean, that just it feels like it must be an incredibly new time for you, all of this.
Yeah, and on top of that, when that same week of, you know, coming back and winning the Emmys, I was also 14 weeks pregnant.
Uh-huh.
And which was not planned. And I just had a kid in March on top of it all while we were finishing second season. Thank you. He came a week early. So I missed the last week of production because he was supposed to come the last day of production. And I, you know, still finished all the post, and I took, I think the Friday that I gave birth off, and then Monday, and then Tuesday I was back
in
the edit, but
that's insane.
I know it's not a brag.
No.
That's a desperate cry for help. But yeah, I mean, so much has happened in such a short amount of time, and it is surreal and incredible, and like this moment that I know can never happen again. And so I'm really doing my very best to enjoy it and live in the moment. And it's really difficult sometimes, because then like the stress of like, oh my God, now we have to make the next season. Is that going to be as good now that we made this one?
So good. Season two is so good. And the ending is a perfection of figuring out what comes next. So good. I wanted to ask quickly about the episode on the cruise ship, because I love how the show balances comedy and drama and tackling bigger issues without feeling, you know, preachy or losing itself. But the conversation that Ava and Deborah have on the boat about sexuality, as someone who's a major ally for LGBTQ+, there was a part of me that got worried about changing the idea of you're not born gay because of the restrictions and potential legal fights already being faced and that seem to be coming down the pike for LGBTQ plus people. Was there any concern that that conversation, instead of being illuminating and freeing for people, might stir up that conversation in a way that isn't serving that
productive
community? Yeah,
of course that was a concern, and I think our intention wasn't, you know, to dismiss the idea that people are born a certain way. I think our intention was to say, yes, you can be born a certain way, but what you really need to do is to make sure to ask yourself, what is it that I actually want? What do I actually desire? And to actually, you know, figure it out. I think like Deborah was saying, she's like, I'm straight, so I was straight, and never really, really considered it. And I think that that's part of, you know, what we want to say in general, which is like, you know, of course people are born a certain way, but do they even ask themselves what that really is? And I think, you know, whether it is just the orientation or your performance of gender, whether, you know, I think that that's like such a big issue to me in general with just a binary, is that, you know, by saying like, oh, men should be dressed or behave this way and girls should dress or behave that way, and by eliminating the spectrum, I mean, I think that that's what people seem to be, seems a lot of people are so afraid of that, of living outside the binary, which is why people are so, I guess, have so much hate towards transness or even against, like, you know, drag queens reading books to children, is to say, oh, if you expose them to the idea that you don't have to live in this binary and that you can live anywhere you want and however you want, that's so liberating. What that does is then force people to ask themselves, well, what am I actually? And that's, I think, seeds a lot of fear into them, because it's so much, they want to just live in this world where men are men and women are women and anything else is scary to them, which is sad, because the truth is the truth will set you free. And so it's just, to me, you know, whether or not it's on this show and having that conversation, or, you know, in Babysitter's Club, you know, having one of the babysitters care for a trans child, or even on Broad City, having Abby, like, you know, think that she's straight for most of the show, but then her realizing actually maybe she does want to date women. You know, I think it's like, it's so important for us to say, like, don't close yourself off to exploring what that is and figuring out what you actually desire to be, whether it's orientation wise or gender wise or whatever, because living authentically is the only way to live in the brief time we're on this little marble, you know?
And the idea that it would be limiting or scary instead of completely freeing is what's so sad about it. I have a friend who just realized at 41 that she wanted to date women, and I do think you're born with the capacity to be along a spectrum, and so much of what society tells you and how you view yourself within the confines of the expectations for you makes it so that one day you can wake up and be like, whoa, wait a minute, there's this whole other thing I never even considered, that these feelings might be because of this or otherwise. And I think it was a really powerful moment in the show and so fascinating. And that's why there was the part of me that was like, oh, I'm nervous about this, but I also love it. And I think it's so interesting and thoughtful. We're running out of time here, and I could talk about Hacks forever. And it's so fantastic. I hope everyone's watching it. But I want to quickly ask what's next for you. I see an untitled Kevin Hart project and Hot Robot with someone who also has the last name in yellow.
Yeah.
Is that a sister?
It is. It's my little sister. Okay, she's good. She's a comedy writer. She actually wrote on the other two, season two. Okay. and she's written out on a bunch of things. But yeah, she kind of started working at the production company that produced Broad City right out of college, and kind of started as more of an exec, but then became a writer about three or four years ago, and is absolutely killing it. And she has this show, Hot Robot, that we've set up at HBO Max that I can say a little bit about it, I think. But the idea is that it's loosely based on a real experience she had, which is that it's a robot, a hot woman robot that is created to the idea is like it's created to be a like kind of fun party robot, and so she's hired to interact with it to make it more sentient and more like a cool girl. But then when the nefarious plans of the Blackwater style company that created it come to light, she decides to help the robot escape from the bonds, and they
that sounds fascinating.
Yes.
Is it a comedy or
it's a comedy. It is a comedy.
Okay, I'm in. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And what's the Kevin Hart project?
Oh, I really hope that it gets made, but I don't know if it will. But it's essentially like Taken, but with a real dad. So instead of having special skills, he has dad skills. His daughter gets kidnapped.
I have a particularly limiting set of skills.
Yes, exactly. And so his daughter is kidnapped, and he and his ex-wife have to bury the hatchet to try to get her back in Europe.
Okay. All right. I like that. Well, congrats on all your success.
Thank you.
Just keep creating this amazing stuff. It's been so
fun. Oh, I appreciate it.
To engage with. Before I let you go, you do have to do the one thing that everybody does and nobody expects.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It's the Spanish Inquisition speed round. Number one, your current career is canceled. What job do you do instead?
I hate to say it, but politics/community organizing.
Okay. Don't hate to say it.
I was going to say hate to say politician, but then I switched it to community organizing.
There you go.
Maybe that's where I got to go. But I think that I might do that either way, even if my job is canceled or not.
Yeah, we might be required to in order to save the planet from ourselves. Number two, what's the most scared you've ever been?
One time in a flight from Provincetown to Boston. We almost crashed, and I was really afraid. I wrote my vows on that flight, though.
There you go. Number three, you could be the best in the world at one thing for one day. What is it?
I guess it would be really cool to speak every language for a day.
Ooh, that would be really cool.
Right?
Number four, what current celebrity from music, politics, TV, sports would you most like to be your best friend?
Aw. I mean, everyone does say Oprah, so I'm not going to say Oprah. I would like to be best friends with Michelle Obama for a day or for however long. I would
forever,
like to
and ever,
forever
and ever.
As long as she'll
Did
have.
Did we already make Amy Poehler our best friend?
I wouldn't say best friend, but we've made her a friend. Yeah.
Jellyfish. Number five, what's your biggest, most meaningless pet peeve?
I mean, it's not meaningless. My biggest pet peeve is when I ask somebody on set how long something will be, and then it's twice as long to do.
That's allowed. Number six, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
One time I was just gotten my license, and I was at my tennis club, and there's a bunch of people waiting outside because it was done for the day and all the kids were getting picked up. And I like pulled up to kind of like show off that I had a license, but I hit the like parking brake before I hit the brake. I hit like went into park before I hit the brake or something, and the car and it was in front of truly like 30 people who all like hysterically screamed and laughed at me.
Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My patience.
Ditto. But if we're patient, how will we get all the things done?
Okay, you know what?
I vacillate between needing to be more patient and needing everyone else to hurry the fuck up.
Great, I take it back. Varicose veins.
There you go. Number eight, any musician or band, alive or dead, can play your next party. Who is it?
You know, I've really been feeling recently like I'd like to for Sheryl Crow to play Tuesday Night Music Club in its entirety for me. Wouldn't that be fun?
She was at our ESPNW summit like 4 years ago. So it was just a couple hundred of us, and she crushed. So fun.
So
and
cool.
Interesting to hear speak as well. Mm-hmm. Number nine, what would you consider your biggest failure?
I guess Rough Night not doing better at the box office.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. But as always, I think very successful people tend to spin those into lessons. So I imagine there's a lot figured out as a result of that, too.
100%.
And finally, number 10, what three individual words would you most hope that people would use to describe you?
Passionate. I'd like to be called smart. I think that's cool. Mm-hmm. Okay. And fair.
Passionate, smart, and fair. Those are wonderful. Hey, thanks so much for doing this. I know you're swamped
with
baby and season two promotions and everything else. So it was very cool to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It was so fun.
That's what she said.
Oh, yeah. One more thing. So this is the place for me to rant, rave, everything in between. Tell you what to watch, what to read, what to listen to. Give you an opinion on something. Really, whatever's on my mind. And after talking to Lucia, it's go watch Hacks if you haven't. Seasons 1 and 2 are out. Go watch Broad City. Go watch that Blake Griffin episode. It's unbelievable. Go watch the other two. So funny. I hadn't realized there was a new season out. I'm on it. Also, let's all watch Rough Night. The cast is incredible. We now know that the writer-director is excellent and cool as hell. So let's give it a shot. Let's go check out that film she's very proud of and not enough of us saw. It's available for a really small fee on Amazon Prime and YouTube. So maybe we all just enjoy a little herkle-derkling tomorrow morning and watch it in bed. Let's do it. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.